Cambridge Certificate of Proficiency in English, Listening Test. Test 4.
I'm going to give you the instructions for this test. I'll introduce each part of the test and give you time to look at the questions. At the start of each piece, you'll hear this sound. You'll hear each piece twice. Remember, while you're listening, write your answers on the question paper. You'll have 5 minutes at the end of the test to copy your answers onto the separate answer sheet. There'll now be a pause. Please ask any questions now because you must not speak during the test. Now open your question paper and look at part one. You'll hear 4 different extracts. For questions 1 to 8, choose the answer, A, B or C, which fits best according to what you hear. There are 2 questions for each extract. Extract 1.
We were living in Zambia and my parents took me to the Victoria Falls. I must have realised even then that every fall has its own character. Big is not always beautiful. A lacy ribbon spilling over a cliff can change mood and appearance on the whim of the sun going behind a cloud. Likewise, with a roaring cascade, even the note can differ. Falls are as capricious as they are complex, visually and audibly. You can visit the same fall 3 days in a row and find that one day it's aloof, the next it's having a tantrum with such fury that one backs away, and the day after it will be gurgling with affection. Falls come and go, so only the big year-round ones are marked on maps. Many dry up in summer and spring into life only after rain. That's why I use contours on the map, to assess where a fall might be. Then, when I want to take a photograph, I calculate the angle of light at dawn to achieve the maximum effect. Then I sit and wait for a passing shower. We were living in Zambia and my parents took me to the Victoria Falls. I must have realised even then that every fall has its own character. Big is not always beautiful. A lacy ribbon spilling over a cliff can change mood and appearance on the whim of the sun going behind a cloud. Likewise, with a roaring cascade, even the note can differ. Falls are as capricious as they are complex, visually and audibly. You can visit the same fall 3 days in a row and find that one day it's aloof, the next it's having a tantrum with such fury that one backs away, and the day after it will be gurgling with affection. Falls come and go, so only the big year-round ones are marked on maps. Many dry up in summer and spring into life only after rain. That's why I use contours on the map, to assess where a fall might be. Then, when I want to take a photograph, I calculate the angle of light at dawn to achieve the maximum effect. Then I sit and wait for a passing shower.
Extract 2.
So, Professor, what do restorers do?
Restorers work on old paintings which are anything from 1 century to 7 centuries old and are, as a result, covered with layers of discoloured varnish and grime. The main aim of restoration is to give people a sense of being able to look at the works without the veil of ages. Restorers can release a painting, not back to its pristine state, which is sadly not feasible, but to something which gives some feeling of the real liveliness the painting had when it was first painted.
Some critics say we should leave the paintings alone, as by stripping off the old varnish and cleaning them, we're creating a lot of disharmonies and getting further away from what the artist intended.
Well, in my view, responsible restorers are in effect making a choice, based upon both science and aesthetics, as to how a painting can look best in terms of the demands we make on the paintings. There is, in a sense, a period choice to be made, but every period has made that choice, and choosing not to intervene is a kind of period choice as well.
So, Professor, what do restorers do?
Restorers work on old paintings which are anything from 1 century to 7 centuries old and are, as a result, covered with layers of discoloured varnish and grime. The main aim of restoration is to give people a sense of being able to look at the works without the veil of ages. Restorers can release a painting, not back to its pristine state, which is sadly not feasible, but to something which gives some feeling of the real liveliness the painting had when it was first painted.
Some critics say we should leave the paintings alone, as by stripping off the old varnish and cleaning them, we're creating a lot of disharmonies and getting further away from what the artist intended.
Well, in my view, responsible restorers are in effect making a choice, based upon both science and aesthetics, as to how a painting can look best in terms of the demands we make on the paintings. There is, in a sense, a period choice to be made, but every period has made that choice, and choosing not to intervene is a kind of period choice as well.
Extract 3.
First there was a production line, and then a factory, and then a vacuum cleaner like no other in the world, in silver, with yellow trim, working on new principles. All a tribute to John's belief that the product is right. 2 million have now been bought, and it's the biggest selling cleaner in Britain, outstripping the established manufacturers. The Dixon Empire is now centred on a massive factory in the south of England, full of new machinery and cool colours chosen by John's wife. With 1,000 people already employed by the firm, it's now in the middle of a huge expansion. A purpose-built plant next door is due to open next summer, meaning the output will double. In a world of high technology, many business people now find manufacturing much less inspiring than services or manipulating data. But John is passionate about the thing, something which distinguishes him from most of the people in British business. First there was a production line, and then a factory, and then a vacuum cleaner like no other in the world, in silver, with yellow trim, working on new principles. All a tribute to John's belief that the product is right. 2 million have now been bought, and it's the biggest selling cleaner in Britain, outstripping the established manufacturers. The Dixon Empire is now centred on a massive factory in the south of England, full of new machinery and cool colours chosen by John's wife. With 1,000 people already employed by the firm, it's now in the middle of a huge expansion. A purpose-built plant next door is due to open next summer, meaning the output will double. In a world of high technology, many business people now find manufacturing much less inspiring than services or manipulating data. But John is passionate about the thing, something which distinguishes him from most of the people in British business.
Extract 4.
We inhale it, eat it, and walk around in clouds of it. But in spite of the size and ubiquity of its tiny particles, dust is far from unimportant, can even have world-shaping impact. Take the soils of Jamaica and Barbados. They began life as sand, blown a speck at a time from the Sahara Desert. In The Secret Life of Dust, Hannah Holmes dates her obsession with dust to a visit to the Gobi Desert. This slim volume represents an enthrallingly non-technical glimpse into this unexpectedly fascinating field of study, and Holmes's enthusiasm shines through, along with her admiration for the people who investigate it. Dust researchers have to be meticulous and imaginative as they try to capture the tiny specks of evidence they spend their lives analysing. Holmes interviews dozens of them, and her thumbnail sketches give a vivid impression of fellow obsessives tramping across deserts and up volcanoes to collect samples and then teasing the secrets from their minuscule catches. We inhale it, eat it, and walk around in clouds of it. But in spite of the size and ubiquity of its tiny particles, dust is far from unimportant, can even have world-shaping impact. Take the soils of Jamaica and Barbados. They began life as sand, blown a speck at a time from the Sahara Desert. In The Secret Life of Dust, Hannah Holmes dates her obsession with dust to a visit to the Gobi Desert. This slim volume represents an enthrallingly non-technical glimpse into this unexpectedly fascinating field of study, and Holmes's enthusiasm shines through, along with her admiration for the people who investigate it. Dust researchers have to be meticulous and imaginative as they try to capture the tiny specks of evidence they spend their lives analysing. Holmes interviews dozens of them, and her thumbnail sketches give a vivid impression of fellow obsessives tramping across deserts and up volcanoes to collect samples and then teasing the secrets from their minuscule catches.
That's the end of part one.